A very warm welcome to this evening's event, which is Freedom in Transition, hosted by the LSE's European Institute. And my name is Abby Innes. I'm an Associate Professor of Political Economy here at the Institute, and I'll be chairing this event. And I am really delighted to welcome our speaker, Professor Leah Eap. But very quickly, before I do that properly, I have a few housekeeping announcements. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Transition. And this event is being recorded, and we hope to make the event available as a podcast, assuming we have no major technical difficulties on the way. So to our speaker, Leah Eap is Professor in Political Theory in the LSE's Government Department, and she's also an Adjunct Associate Professor in Philosophy at the Research School of Social Sciences, Australian National University. And Leah is a normative political theorist. So she's an expert on democratic theory, theories of justice, including on issues of migration and territorial rights. She's also, and that's obviously of particular relevance and interest for us today, an expert on Marxism and critical theory, and also on Enlightenment political theory, not least the writings of Immanuel Kant. And again, we are going to come back to Kant later. Leah's done a really wonderful and very unusual, and I think very brave thing for an academic, which is that she has stepped outside from behind the veil of sort of disinterested, impersonal analysis to write a really astonishing and touching memoir of growing up in the last years of Albanian communism and living through the very considerable shocks of the market transition, the transition supposedly to supposedly self-regulating free markets. And the book is called Free, Coming of Age at the End of History. So what we're going to do today is explore some of the observations and insights that really pour from the pages of this wonderful book. To do this, Leah is going to start by introducing the book, and I'm going to ask her just a few of the questions that came to me as I had the pleasure of reading it. But then in the sort of last third half of this session, what we'd really like to do is open this up to a Q&A. For you, the audience. So can you please use the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen? And I'm going to pose as many of those questions as we have time for. Also, please do let us know your affiliation, your name and your affiliation, if you're happy to attach that to your question. That option should be available pretty much from the beginning. So yeah, think of your questions and do send them to us. But let's begin by handing over to Leah, who's going to introduce the book for us.
Great, thank you very much. Thank you everyone for joining and for hosting me. So the larger philosophical theme that animates the book is the idea of freedom. And what I try to do is to explain what individual agency and responsibility look like when there are larger social constraints and structures of power that inhibit that individual agency. And the book really explores how this yearning for freedom is at the heart of all the choices and all the dilemmas faced by different characters, who each of them also have different conceptions of what freedom is and what it takes to realize it, and who encounter these dilemmas as they try to navigate different political systems at a time of transition. And some of the characters are used to these transitions, like my grandmother, others are new to them, like me. The book is set in Albania, which is in many ways what mathematicians or political scientists or economists call a limit case. A limit case is one where you can test a particular component or a theory or a value in a kind of extreme form. And so Albania is a limit because one sees how these ideas of freedom shape lives in different political systems, in state socialism and capitalist liberalism, which are both often presented as rivals to each other and have a different ethos and different sets of values and different sets of disillusionments. And the book is written from the point of view of a young girl who is making this transition also from childhood to adulthood. And so it's a coming of age story. And it's a coming of age story whose main character's personal, cognitive and also emotional evolution coincide with the evolution or the revolution of her country from one political system to the other. And it's so it's a coming of age story, both for the individual and for the country. And in both cases, it's a relatively traumatic coming of age story. In the personal case, it's traumatic because we tend to learn ideas of freedom and responsibility subject to the social environment in which we grow up. But in this case, these two different sides of influence, so the family on the one hand and the state on the other, are in contrast with each other. Because the character, that is me, grows up in this dissident family without knowing it, and so is equally subjected to the power and influence of the state on the one hand and of the family in the other. And so on the one hand, she is told to be a good citizen, as a good pioneer, but also doesn't know that her great-grandfather is a fascist who was personally responsible for handing the sovereignty of Albania to Italian occupiers during the Second World War, which then means that this period of Albanian history has a particular legacy on the family. She doesn't know that her grandfather is even a political prisoner for 15 years, or that her mother comes from bourgeois property-owning family. And so, and of course, in every society that is divided by class, whether it's socialism or liberalism, which social class you come from shapes the opportunities that you have in the future. And in this case, it's extreme because these influences bring in different directions. And so that's why in the book, there isn't a unified interpretation of the purposes and of the motives of different characters, but rather an effort to show how these different stories shape the self-understanding of someone who grows up in a context where these different things go on at once, and also shapes her understanding of what is freedom and how should one think of it in different political systems, which is the larger story that I try to tell in the book. And of course, more generally in the book, there's different characters, each of which has a different idea of freedom. So my mother has what you might call a classical liberal idea of freedom, negative freedoms. You are free to the extent that nobody stops you from doing certain things like traveling or dressing in a certain way or saying certain things in public. And this animates all her struggles in the book. And it also animates the struggles of the country to emerge from state socialism and to embrace this idea of liberal negative freedom. My father has a slightly different conception, more social idea of freedom, which is what one might call positive freedom, that's to say freedom too, and whereby it's not enough to be stopped from doing certain things. You are only free to the extent that you have opportunities available to realize yourself. And his dilemmas become particularly relevant in the second part of the book, which is about liberalism and where he's in a position of having to make decisions that affect other people and often also their opportunities for freedom, which gives him a set of dilemmas that are very difficult for him. And then finally, there is this there's grandmother's idea of freedom, which is the one that I am more philosophically attracted to, which is this idea of freedom as moral agency, whereby we are free to the extent that we make moral decisions while being aware of all the constraints around us. And she's a good example of this idea because on the one hand, she's a direct victim of injustice. She's transitioned from different political systems, but somehow in the book, she always claims that she's found ways of retaining her dignity to make the right decisions and to establish her will, even in these purely oppressive circumstances. And really the story in the book is that through the history of my family and through this set of reflections about this limit case, like Albania, I wanted to react to what I think has become a kind of dominant liberal or maybe even left liberal way of thinking about the end of the Cold War and these related ideas about the end of history, and whereby the dominant tendencies that people relate to countries or groups who don't share a straightforward liberal trajectory by thinking of the West or of these liberal conceptions as the ones that embody the kind of moral high ground and that are ready to enable people to free themselves and to free them, their countries from their backwardness and their plight. And by talking about the different ideas of freedom in a limit case like Albania and in a limit case like my family in Albania, I wanted to highlight the kind of risk of paternalism in that way of thinking, which ends up, I think, often perpetuating structures of oppression rather than liberating people. And so, of course, Albania was extreme in its heroic rejection of these imported models of first Soviet socialism and then extreme in its commitment to Western liberal values. But my grandmother was maybe extreme in pretending that, you know, she was always the author of her life and she always retained her dignity. But I thought it was important to tell that story as a story of searching for freedom, not as one that is just a story of tragedy and oppression, but as a kind of continuous search for freedom, both individual and collective. So I think I'll just maybe stop there. Hope that wraps up.
Fantastic. That's a wonderful summary of an incredibly complex book. I mean, that one of the things that really struck me with the book was the clarity with which you set out your emerging realization as a girl and as a young woman that you were living through one regime based on a total explanation for how societies are supposed to operate, only to find it being replaced in the transition by another total explanation for how the political economy was supposed to operate, sort of one materialist utopia being replaced by its mirror image. And as you've explained there, and as is so beautiful in the book, is that particularly in the transition years, that you expose the tensions, the immediate tensions between the sort of the theory of this frictionless, efficient market as your mother was very quickly an advocate for, and the immediate human dilemmas that it pulled into being immediately, that your father had to live through as someone trying to be a responsible employer and you know, and a responsible manager of this incredibly disruptive and sort of in many ways very destructive transition, you know, this huge upheaval of the political economy. And having lived through it, my first question would be, with the benefit of hindsight, would you say that one of these systems was more damaging than the other in attacking and undermining the kind of moral agency that your grandmother, you know, hung on to? Is one of these materialist utopias more damaging to family and friendship and empathy and social solidarity than another? Or are the forms of damage simply too different for there to be any kind of meaningful comparison?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think this is a really difficult, really good question and a really difficult question, because I think it's the types of relationship really change dramatically, and their relationships to freedom are also very, very different in the different systems. And so it's really hard to compare them to one another. And it's really hard to think about, you know, does one disrupt more social relations than the other? Because ultimately social relations really change in the transition from one to the other. And the other reason it's also difficult, I think it's because you're analyzing two very different kinds of oppression. On the one hand, you have a kind of oppression by an agent. And so you have a state, you have the party, you have a structure of cooperation, you have bureaucracy, and you have rules that are made by people. And of course, with the backing of laws, but where it's much more easy to identify responsible perpetrators of these kinds of oppression. And in the other one, it's a very difficult and very different kind of oppression, because it's much more anonymous and perhaps equally pervasive, but it's really hard to identify who is actually responsible for the kinds of unfreedom. So while in the case of a violation of negative freedom, you have a law that tells you, you know, if you do this, you'll end up in prison, and you know who puts you in prison, and you know who's directly responsible for curtailing your freedom. Yes, you can, yeah. Sorry, it's here. Sorry, my son is just here asking for the iPad. So on the one hand, you have this kind of immediate responsibility for curtailing freedom. And in the other one, in the other system, there isn't a rule, there isn't anyone that says, you know, you're no longer free or you can't do this. In principle, you're free to do everything, and in principle, you have access to everything. But in the way in which societal interactions operate, and in this chain of complicity, compliance, anonymous sort of unintended consequences of anonymous transactions, there are these different forms of unfreedom that are generated, and where the costs and the externalities often fall on impersonal actors. So it's the markets, or it's the transition, or it's kind of this general move. So I'd say it's really hard. I mean, on the one hand, I think it's fair to say that one of the things that I reflect in the book on is the loss of, to go back to this theme of trust and solidarity that you mentioned, is the loss of trust and solidarity and these kind of neighborly relationships of coming to help each other and, you know, going and asking someone for something when you didn't have it, which was very common in communist Albania, which clearly disappeared afterwards. And of course, on the one hand, that's a kind of solidarity in hardship, but also it's a solidarity that happens against the background of a very deep level of suspicion also towards neighbors and friends and people because of all the system of spying and the secret police and the pervasiveness of the controlling apparatus. And so it's a very weird combination of, on the one hand, relying on friends and neighbors and cousins and relatives for everything, but on the other hand, suspecting everyone of everything as well. And this is the second theme, I think, has been much more present in discussions around Eastern Europe and the transition and so on. But the first one, which everybody acknowledges, it's really hard to explain how these two can coexist, how this level of kind of deep suspicion can coexist. And in the second, in the kind of the second part, the post-1990, I think what's really interesting to reflect on is this opening up to outsiders. And so you're in this society that was completely shut, completely isolated, cut off completely from the West, and idealizing in many ways what was going on in the West, and then opening up with a very quick succession of events, and then being very trustful of the West precisely because of this weird dynamic of replacing suspicion with complete trust. And so you go from a paranoid state that tells you everybody outside Albania is an enemy to saying everybody outside Albania is a kind of authority who in some ways knows better than locals what needs to be done. And that's the dynamic of trust is very strange and very different, because then people trust the experts and trust the outsiders and trust the foreigners. And in some ways they sort of, they trust too much, because they trust them in the advice that they give, in the policies that they prescribe, without having the courage to say, actually, this is something that the locals know better, or this is something where the line should be drawn. Or so there's this kind of strange combination again of very deep trust, but which sometimes backfires.
And I think one of the really fascinating things about that, not just in Albania, but in the region as a whole in the 90s and indeed in the West with Thatcherism and Reaganism, was the kind of naturalistic fallacy around the arguments for radical free markets. It's a very ahistorical, dehistoricized rendition of how markets will work, that they are the natural predetermined law of nature almost. And so there's this rather intense irony in coming from a system of, you know, Marxist-Leninist thought that thinks in terms of predetermined laws of economic motion and rejecting those as constructed and engineered and misconceived. Only to then be advised, not just by the West, but by, you know, there were conversations in between the USSR and the West right through the Cold War between economists, neoclassical economists, and Soviet economists about how you could reform the Soviet system, and ultimately the reformers in these systems giving up and saying, no, we have to go with a really kind of radical version of free market economics. But the language of it, as you say, the kind of popular language of it, is common sense. Mm-hmm. This is a return to nature.
Yeah. And I wonder whether that's in some ways connected to this narrative about the end of history and the end of rivalry between the East and the West, and the fact that this was the worldview of a group or of an entity that in some ways emerged triumphant from this conflict or thought they emerged triumphant from this confrontation. And so in a way, I think the idea is that now you don't have an obstacle to the realization of free market freedom. There's no reason why the free markets shouldn't work the way in which they're supposed to work in the ideal, because the real obstacles aren't there anymore. And so I think that's maybe why you witness this return of this kind of utopian idealized understanding of, you know, how markets are supposed to work and what free societies consist of and so on. Because I think it, in some ways, it's a defeat of the alternative that enables that. Whereas when you always have an alternative, there's possibly always an exploration of third models or of dialectical combinations, or there is more accommodation, there's more compromise that needs to be made. And when the alternative is just not there anymore, not even in theory, because it's just been defeated and you have this very simple argument that it's been defeated, then you can return to the uncompromising stance and you can return to that kind of purity of the neoliberal worldview, which is ultimately what ended up happening and what came back to these societies and it came back in that form, I think, because of this outcome of this struggle.
Well, and the extraordinary, I mean, it's sort of written in the theoretical small print of neoliberalism, but one of the really extraordinary things is also an argument for the withering away of the state,
right?
As the Leninist argument is, you know, that the frictionless utopia yeah. will operate when the state has withered away, and that's, you know, they both have that aspiration. They're both incredible mirror images to that extent.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Although I'd say that there is a difference in the sense mm-hmm. that in the kind of materialist Leninist outlook, the state withers away as a result of spontaneous processes. Whereas in this case, in post 1990, the efforts were all efforts to actually destroy the state. And so yeah. it took the form of a direct intervention in the structures that held together the state to try and act by the theory and to say, look, we, you know, state intervention is damaging. And I'm sure for many people, this was done in good faith and out of mm-hmm. sheer commitment to these ideas, and nobody intended any harm, which is part of my story about freedom, how, you know, and unfreedom in a way, how these constraints on freedom emerge not because anyone wants to be bad or wants to hinder other people or wants to prevent them from being free. It's just that they commit to this worldview, the result of which is that the costs have to be borne. And this is why I think there's also this parallel with the story about transition that was told in communist Albania, that there's these costs of transition and we all need to absorb them and make sacrifices. And now we make sacrifices as well. It's just that the story has changed and the utopia is slightly different.
And again, extraordinarily dehistoricized in the sense that there's no discussion of the developmental state, which has played a pivotal role in real emerging markets and in the evolution of capitalism. You know, that modern advanced liberal democratic capitalism didn't emerge in the absence of the state. And so this, as you say, this deconstruction of the state is only going to work if there is some transcendental, metaphysical, predetermined economic reality that will bring the market into creation simply by force of its own logic and sort of efficiency. So it's an extraordinary to think how different these transitions would have been had they occurred in the 60s or the 70s, yeah. for example, had there been a different dominant orthodoxy at the time. I mean, this actually gets us to Kant, and I'll try and explain why. It's worth pointing out that most academics would be absolutely thrilled to publish one book within the space of several years, and Leah completed the heroic feat of publishing two last year. So not just this beautiful memoir, but also a monograph on Kant called The Architectonic of Reason. And bear with me, this is why I'm sort of introducing this into a discussion about free. Architectonic explores three questions raised in Kant's first critique, namely, what can I know, what should I do, and what may I hope? And if you've read Free, you'll understand why it brings me to the next question, which is, how influential, Leah, do you think the experiences you relate in the book are to you becoming a Kantian? It's very difficult to separate our biographies from our kind of intellectual, you know, priors and sort of beliefs, but can you identify points in your history where you were almost probably becoming a Kantian before you knew Kant, possibly, and then recognizing the way you thought in Kantian reason, or the other way around?
Yeah, I think, I mean, yes, definitely. And this is something that I only realized actually after writing the book. So the book was like a form of understanding where mm-hmm. the commitments come from. But I think it's fair to say that the first Kantian I met was my grandmother, even though she didn't know she was a Kantian. And the reason I think I say that is that she had this very firm commitment to reason. And she was a very rational person and someone who believes in rationality, but not just in rationality as a matter of kind of rational calculation, but mm-hmm. also as a rationality as a kind of practical stance, as a moral stance, and as a moral stance that is self-sufficient in a way, where you don't need to rely to other authorities to explain why are we moral, why do we do the right thing. Being reasonable or having reason is just that. That's enough. And this was something that I was first exposed to, I guess, with her through conversations about God, because she always said to me, you know, you need to do the right thing, and you mustn't do the right thing because you're expecting to be rewarded, or because you're expecting money from it, or because you're expecting people to acknowledge how nice you were and being good. Sometimes none of these things happens. And the fact that it doesn't happen doesn't mean that it's not the right thing to do. It's just still the right thing to do. It's just the world may or may not recognize it, but the consequences of your action are irrelevant to deciding whether this is the right thing to do. And you will know that it's the right thing to do if you kind of listen to yourself. And she more or less said it like this, and Kant more or less says it like this, but explains where does moral agency come from. And when he says it's not a matter of consequences, it's not a matter of calculation, it's not a matter of inclination and kind of feeling your passion driving you one way or another, you just know what your duty is, and you have to do your duty regardless of the consequences, even if the consequences will never be acknowledged, and even if there will never be any reward. So this was extremely powerful for me in terms of, I think, being attracted to that moral philosophy, but having had the exposure to that way of thinking about morality, even before I knew what moral philosophy is, in a way, through my grandmother. And perhaps this is sometimes how, and you know, if you're a philosopher, then you have a chance to articulate what your moral commitments are and why you believe in them. But I think maybe all of us at one point or other in our lives have had these influences, you know, from education or from parents or from school or from friendships or whatever, from our social networks. And we have these influences and we don't quite know where they come from, but then, you know, you study moral philosophy and then you realize, okay, the reason I'm attracted to this way of thinking may be to do with this particular, that's one element of it. And the other element that is really important to Kantianism, I think, which again, I kind of connect to my grandmother and to my story of growing up now connect to that story of growing up in Albania, is the importance of criticism and the importance of distinguishing criticism from two things that are in some ways rivals to criticism, one of which is dogmatism and the embrace of dogma, which I think is like the first part of my life in a way. So the first half of the book is all about the power of dogma and the force of dogmatism and how that shapes ideologies and someone's life. And the second part is, so the one reason for Kant is in this kind of dual struggle, on the one hand against dogmatism, and on the other hand, against skepticism, because the opposite of dogmatism is when there is no more dogma, what do you believe in? And there's a risk that you don't believe in anything. Mm-hmm. So skepticism is this kind of philosophical alternative to dogmatism. And Kant is equally firm in his rejection of skepticism, because he thinks that we also need a foundation for morality and for moral action, and skepticism isn't enough and can't give us that. And so then you have this reason that is in this dual fight against dogmatism on the one hand and skepticism on the other. And sometimes when I think about the second half, and often also experiences of my friends growing up in Eastern Europe in the transition after 1990, I think again, skepticism is a very pervasive state of mind, because mm-hmm. you've abandoned this world with this kind of belief in socialism and freedom and all the good things. And you're in this other world where you're asked to make compromises, you see things aren't quite working, you see that there isn't really an alternative to go back to what, that would be a bad idea to go back to what you had, but you also can't think of anything better. And so I think we're all in this kind of state of disbelief about the world and in this general skepticism about everything, you know, political theories and worldviews and political agents and so on. And I think that's also not a great predicament to be in a way, because it can also be paralyzing, and it can fuel negative attitudes towards politics, it can fuel cynicism, it can fuel a certain indifference, and again, that doesn't really help, doesn't contribute to solve problem. So I think my grandmother, again, was not a dogmatic, and she was not a skeptic either. She always said, you have to believe in something. And this was something that I then recognized in Kant as well afterwards, this necessity of embracing reason and doubt, and finding that doubt can be a source of strength, and that we don't need to be afraid of being doubtful and critical, but that in fact we can build from there, from that criticism.
I mean, that's fascinating, because it actually it actually gets to your work with your husband and my colleague, Jonathan White, Professor Jonathan White, on partisanship as well in some ways. So, and forgive me, this is going to be a political economist terrible reading of philosophy, right? So correct me here. But so if my understanding of Kantian, the Kantian philosophy of knowledge is kind of remotely right, part of what he's arguing is in this argument against dogmatism, is that we can never know enough about the way the world works to understand how we got here. There's no Archimedean point where you can stand and sort of understand the totality of the world that allows you to then know sort of exactly what you should do next. And so it seems to me that a politics that could operate with that kind of fundamental intellectual humility, you know, that accepted the limits of human reason would never be so tempted by the materialist utopias that we're talking about, would have that sort of epistemological unease about the idea that anyone, whether Lenin or Milton Friedman, could have such a complete knowledge of some distinct economic metaphysics that governs society. So we'd be less likely to discount our present suffering for the name of these kind of existential rules. But the trouble is, it's quite hard to sell humility as a political proposition. You know, you compare it to the combat tasks and the heroism of the great schemes, you know, whether it's Soviet socialism or, you know, or neoliberalism, the idea that you're going to sort of transform society and make it completely efficient. So how do you think that's fed into your writing about partisanship? You know, this, because part of what strikes me listening to you is that there's a deep mental relaxation in either position, in either deciding that we know the way the world works and we're very dogmatic about a particular ideology, or we have no clue. Both of those positions are easier than what Koshakovsky talked about when he talked about the need to stare at the metaphysical horror of, you know, not knowing how, you know, society really works. So where does partisanship come in? How do you solve these things?
So I think it's ultimately about democracy and the fact that I think democracy is a kind of self-correcting practice. And this is maybe the link also with the Kantian reason that I was talking about, this kind of dual struggle against both dogmatism and skepticism, which is sort of reason's stance in the world, is basically to realize that you are equally likely to, you can produce these ideas and these theories that history shows to be wrong, but it's also important to keep producing projects that take us forward. And so there is a kind of, I think there is still a teleology in Kant's philosophy, which is important to me, but the way it should be understood is not as a teleology of nature. It's not a teleology of, you know, things are just this way and they've always been this way and we need to believe in this force other than human reason. But it's a kind of effort to understand how reason engages with the material world in its history. And then particularly political practices, institutional practices emerge, which contain both limitations, but also ways of learning from them, and which contain also insights that might be useful in the future. And so I think the criticism really, or rather from a Kantian perspective, the problem is not so much with ideals as such. I think the problem is with ahistorical ideals, with ideals that are just kind of connected in this very trivial and very superficial and very dry way to human nature without thinking through this historical process through which human nature has to go to realize and to understand itself, both as a source of error, as I say, but also as a source of potentially visions for the future. And the way these learning processes, I think, operate politically, and the way in which they can be, they can become parts of institutions, is through democratic exercise, through democratic agency. There is no other way. You need to enable voices to be articulated in the public sphere, to be part of politics. And it's only once they're part of politics and once we've identified the mechanisms through which they can be part of politics, then democracy becomes this kind of reason in action, reason in practice. And so for me, the connection with the partisanship book is that partisanship or political parties are one kind of agent that we have identified in modernity as connecting the individual to the collective, the state, the public sphere. So that one way of connecting kind of private concerns and conceptions of the good to visions for the transformation of society that can be in principle articulated in the public sphere. And so they're really important intermediaries of democracy, and they're really important in enabling us to see democracy in practice. And, you know, of course, this is also very ideal because as a matter of course, parties often don't operate like that. But in the ideal form, they are the vehicles through which you can channel and articulate people's political commitments in a way that also enables them to be part of this democratic confrontation and democratic exercise. And that therefore enables us to learn from the kind of mistakes and to self-correct our practices. And again, that's the kind of Kantian connection, I think.
What's fascinating about that is it's such a powerful argument, and not one you hear enough, I think, the idea that one of the virtues of democracy is it lets us learn from our failures. It lets us learn from our mistakes rather than it being a kind of a battleground of unsafe certainties. Actually, it's very different. What you're saying is in an evolving and uncertain world, it's only through the representation of people's lived experience and only through, as you say, the offering of new projects, new attempts to solve things, and learning from those attempts that we can have progress, but on the understanding that a progress that will never be finished.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point of arrival. And I think that's one of the peculiar features of the great materialist utopias, again, is that they're so Judeo-Christian in their idea that there is some arrival, that there is some sort of Edenic point, some Elysium where when everything is resolved, then you get this kind of homeostatic world where everything, conflict is gone. You know, it's sort of pre-lapsarian way of thinking about society.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think, for me, that's as a horizon, it's okay to think about it. But then when you think about forms of political agency that we need to have in place to want to be in this world without conflict, or where conflicts are articulated in the right way and so on, it helps to then be grounded and historical and contextual and to think about types of political practice that work, and to also think about democracy, I think, not as either or. So to see that democracy has shades and has nuances, and that it's itself an unfinished project in a way, because the kinds of democracies that we have and the institutions that we have aren't in any way fully representative or offer full equality to everyone, or can capture everyone's concerns and commitments. I mean, they're flawed in many ways. And so it's really important to not reify democracy and say, well, what we have is full democracy, but also not to say, well, we don't have any kind of spaces for democracy. Mm. I think it's really important to kind of, and this is perhaps also, it's really hard because it's hard to live with these tensions in a way.
And how damaging was it in the Albanian experience that democracy and these very radical neoliberal reforms came together? Was there a great danger that the one would contaminate the other, in the sense that if neoliberalism couldn't be made true, it couldn't fulfill the promises that justified it, because it came with democracy?
Yeah, this is a really hard question. I don't think anyone really knows the answer. I think now there is an understanding that it was damaging, and that there was, at one point, there were these two routes, you know, a route towards more radical democratization and another route, which was to increase economic benefits. And I'd say the kind of consequentialist utilitarian thinking won. And the idea was, well, if you improve material well-being, or if you adopt these economic recipes that will enable everybody to kind of get richer, then democracy will come as well. And what we see now, I think, in the world is actually the proof that that wasn't the case, that if you don't fight for democracy, you don't get democracy via these other means. And so there was this kind of, again, in, as you said, in a parallel way to this teleology of economic justice in Marxism, this idea that, you know, you get some economic improvement, economic well-being, that will also deliver democracy. And similarly with the Marxist period, the idea was that you have economic Marxist justice and that will also democratize society. And it, of course it doesn't. And,
yeah.
And so I think, but the other interesting question for me is, and this is again a kind of interesting counterfactual question, is how much did it matter that these states were actually all new states, and they weren't fully formed states, they weren't liberal states to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so these were, I mean, in the case of Albania, again, it's extreme because Albania only became an independent state in 1912. And so, and then it became a socialist state in 1946. So effectively it had existed as a state for not very long before that. And that was, you know, with the Second World War, and before that with various protectorates from great powers and so on. So you have a country that's kind of shaped by the great powers, has never really been democracy, never been a liberal democracy either. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly becomes kind of a communist society and a socialist society. And for me, the bar is so high, and that it's hard to see how the discourse is only limited to post 1990. You have to think about the kind of longer historical trajectory of these countries and how they became states, and how this transition from socialism to liberalism, to capitalism, was also part of their state building and state formation, which I think is still happening now. I mean, they're not fully formed states either. So,
and I think it was a hugely underestimated part of the transition literature and period in the 1990s that just forgot that Western Europe had established all of its democratic institutions under a completely different orthodoxy.
Exactly, yeah. Right?
So under Keynesianism or ordo-liberalism or dirigism in France, they all had a developmental state,
yeah,
as they were also developing their, you know, or renewing or establishing after the Second World War, their, you know, deep democratic institutions. So they could build those through 30 years of tremendous growth and stability. So when neoliberalism came, it came to countries that had this huge institutional resilience. And this is a completely different story in Central Europe, where you're trying to do everything simultaneously in the hardest possible conditions.
Exactly. So I think that the history of these countries in bringing, in delivering, you know, shock therapy and structural reforms and so on, I feel the history was completely erased. People just forgot about it. Like, what kind of countries were they? What kind of background did they have? What kind of institutional development had they had up to that point? And that was, I think, really difficult and really what complicated things.
Well, and I think part of that is an artifact of the fact that the neoclassical economics that brings forward all these ideas is axiomatic deductive, right? It exists in a world, those theories exist in a world that is sociologically flat, right? It's year zero at the beginning of these models, and then these models become the basis of policy, and you see the consequences of that. I need to stop because I could carry on asking you questions for hours, but I'm going to break the promise to the audience if I do that. So, let me turn to a question from Sam Huntington, who is a student actually in the European Institute. And he says, as Abby alluded to, today the word freedom seems most often to be invoked by the economic right. Do you think this usage is something the left should be pushing back on? And if so, how might you suggest trying to reframe or reclaim this word in sort of mainstream political discourse?
Yeah, great. So very much so. I'm very committed to this idea that freedom isn't just for the right. And in fact, what I think is important is to understand that socialist theories emerge in parallel in some ways to liberal theories. They're both theories of modernity that start with the liberal promise of freedom and say, look, actually the liberal society doesn't realize all the freedoms that it promises to bring. And the very first, the beginnings of the discussion around the freedom of the bourgeois and the freedom of the citoyen is exactly that the liberal society, the French Revolution, promises freedom for everyone, but actually what it does is just brings freedom to a particular social class, and namely to the wealthy or the capitalists or however you want to call it. And these opportunities for freedom, by being unequally distributed, mean that freedom as such is effectively not realized. So to me, that critique of liberal modern society that comes from the socialist tradition, you know, if you think about Marx on the Jewish question, is one of the examples, the classical text where this question comes up. But also, if you think about Hegel's critique of civil society and his critique of right, there is a whole body of thought that points exactly at this tension at the heart of the liberal tradition, which is the heart of the liberal tradition is freedom, but it's actually not freedom for everyone. It's only freedom for the employers, freedom for the rich, freedom from the capitalists, freedom for rich states as opposed to poor states, freedom for the states that have colonized other parts of the world and who have developed themselves at their expense. And so it's a kind of story that points to the asymmetries of freedom. So I think that discourse is very powerful because it's a discourse that says, look, the socialists and the, so the left and the right care about the same thing, but let's have a conversation around which of these projects really enables you to have full freedom for everyone, not just for some. And again, that's why democracy is really important, because if you have the sites of democratic contestation, and if these sites of democratic contestation work as they should, then these projects can be articulated and can confront each other in the public sphere, and then you can make the argument, and then it's the, you know, Habermas calls this the force of the better argument. In a way, you can have the sites that enable you to make these claims based on freedom. And then it's not a question of, you know, the right defends freedom, the left defends equality or something like that. It's about a concern that we all have, that is a reasonable and a rational concern to have. And then you can have a confrontation, so you can have a discussion.
And that I think sort of points up some of the difficulties, some of the kind of constraints on democracy that came when social democracy became much more technocratic, sort of arguing in terms of, you know, we can, rather than having these arguments about how these things are fulfilled in practice, talking in more technocratic terms about mending market failures at the microeconomic level, you know, becomes an argument that is too pulled away from these value questions and empirical questions, I think.
Yeah. And in a way, I think that also makes people lose a sense of control over these questions. Mm-hmm. Which is in part then connected to the rise of the populist right and the kind of, you know, the alternatives that promise people control, a bit like Brexit. You know, the whole slogan is take back control, precisely, I think, because it has to do with this sense of anonymity and being at the mercy of these technocratic forces that you don't control, and that is perceived as a loss of freedom, and in fact might be at some level a loss of freedom. Mm-hmm. And the question is, well, what are the alternatives that enable people to kind of take back control, and how plausible are they? And when democracy works as it should, then these alternatives emerge and are articulated properly. And when it doesn't, then you get different, a misappropriation of them.
Well, and I think the skepticism that you were talking about earlier can degrade so easily and naturally into fatalism, a sense that, you know, having lived with these sort of pseudosciences that keep failing to deliver on their promises, then at what point does, for a reasoning person, does their skepticism, you know, their watchful skepticism simply become fatalism and a sense of being washed out of this picture altogether? I think another question from Orlon Ramadani, who is an ex-LSE student, who says, as an Albanian myself, your portrayal of your mother is as very liberal and pro-competition, but lonely, rang true for many females in my life. Would you say there is some connection between the female Albanian experience and this form of liberalism, or that this is purely coincidental? Is there some structural story of where women stood within the old communist system, within Albanian communism, and the nature of the transition that somehow put them in that?
Yeah, I think the way I tell this story is that, and in some ways this is connected to the discourse around female emancipation under socialism in Albania, where the rhetoric of the system was that women were now empowered and they could work and they could do all the jobs that they were. But in fact, what it meant is that women were left to fight for themselves, basically. And my mother is a characterization of that. I mean, she's someone who is extremely strong, and as many Albanian women I know, are really powerful in kind of fighting the men and making arguments and sort of reclaiming their spaces in a ways that are, I think, that really stand out if you compare to their Western female counterparts. But also because of the dynamic, I think because they're kind of left to fight for themselves and they know they have to fight for themselves, it's a kind of fight where they hardly ever come together with others. So it's a fight where everybody is fighting on their own in a way and doesn't know that there's hundreds and thousands of other fights that are going on at the same time. And I think it's partly to do with living in a non-democratic system where you don't have possibilities of articulating oppositional agency, and where, you know, women can't come together. If there's a grievance and you live in a totalitarian state, everybody perceives that grievance and everybody takes the responsibility for fighting against it and does it and stands up for themselves in a way. You know, I have this chapter in the book which the title is, I always carry the knife, because that's what my mother says when she's asked by Western feminists, was there harassment in Albania during communism, and my mom first just, what is harassment? She's not even familiar with the category, but then she understands and she's like, yes, of course, but I always had a knife. And so this idea that, you know, each woman is there with their knife and kind of fighting and ready to pull it out, but in some ways doesn't know about the existence or can't, because of the lack of democratic structures, can't come together with all these others, I think is what brings this highly, in some ways, individualistic and isolated form. So I think it wasn't just down to her being a liberal and a libertarian. I think it was a lot to do also with the experiences that she had developed living in communist Albania.
I think that's one of the most fantastic episodes in the book, because you just portray it beautifully, this sort of slightly condescending Western feminist visit to your mother, and that sort of sense that had she been sort of terribly oppressed and unable to understand her own interests, and then your mother basically says, well, I just carried a knife. I mean, what else are you going to do? It's a wonderful juxtaposition of the kind of force and strength of how women had to, what they had and that they needed, but just that it's articulated in these very different ways and managed in these very different ways. But it's such a window.
And also, I think the kind of weird way in which the rhetoric of empowerment of women, which was very much part of the state discourse, has empowered them, but in this weird form, right? So it's as though they hear this and they hear, you know, now women can do everything. They can be like men, they can work like men and so on. So they're like, okay, fine, then I can carry a knife as well. And I think that it leads to that naturally, but not in ways that are necessarily anticipated by the discourse or by the official doctrine.
Well, and there's a resonance there, for me at least, with the way you talk about friendship and this solidarity as well, that you have a state orthodoxy and message of solidarity, but the lived solidarity is so much in the interstices of this system. It's about people's coping mechanisms within a system that was also brutal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so it produces this profound solidarity, but not history with a capital H, the historical forms.
Not solidarity post-scarcity, but solidarity because of extreme scarcity in a way. Yeah.
Exactly. So that and that gets us back to Kant, right? That the kind of the lived experience and the learning from this lived experience, how much further we might get if we learn from that rather than sort of abstract dehistoricized theory. I have a couple more questions from Valtrak Schelke, Professor Schelke, another of my colleagues. Did you ever ask your parents when they would have told you about the dissident worldview and put you out of your state of Kantian ignorance and hence non-freedom? And what would you have done? What would you have done if you'd had their dilemma?
Yeah, so I this is a question I've asked myself for a long time and asked them as well. They say that they didn't think that it would have been needed, that they think that at some point you reach maturity, and reaching maturity is understanding the dogmas in which you live in a way. And so they always said to me, we had to tell you because things changed and you just were confused and you weren't understanding and so on. But if you had been just a little bit older, you would have figured it out for yourself, because you wouldn't have been allowed, for example, in the youth communist organization because of the family background. And because my family was this kind of dissident family with a well-known surname, they said they were convinced that I would have had these repercussions, and then eventually, feeling the repercussions, I would have worked out everything inductively myself without them needing to tell me anything and just confirming things that I discovered by myself. And so, and for me, this is actually one of the biggest questions I have, because my experience in these first early years was one of complete conformity, and nobody did anything to stop me from conforming, not the school, not my family, not. So everything was going to plan the way in which they went for every other communist pioneer and communist youth organization member. So, and yet it was stopped by events at some point, this process of kind of gradual commitment to the party and to the state. But I think people eventually realized, and this is the experience I hear from, and this another question sometimes I get asked is, do you think, you know, what would you have been if the state had not changed? And I think I would have been a dissident just like my parents were, and would have probably been of the generation of people who hate Marx, hate anything to do with socialist theory or practice, and have no curiosity, just resentment and kind of this deep hatred for everything that reminds them of this brutality that they've lived through. And I think because in my case, I was a child and it was tempered, I don't have this sense of deep resentment and deep hatred for everyone, and almost like a vindicative instinct that other people have who have lived through much harsher circumstances. So yeah, in some ways, I think it was good. It was bad because I discovered in this way, but it was also good perhaps because I think it made me less vehemently opposed to everything that kind of came. And in this, I think it gave me a slightly different way of being open to the history of the left, to other experiences of the left, to, you know, what one might identify as the left in the West, and some more curious about certain things that I think I would have not been curious about.
And sort of fascinating that, again, there's that kind of underlying Kantian position that your parents, or at least your grandmother, seems to have had, which is, you use the word maturity, that maturity is accepting complexity.
Yeah.
And their trust that you would have apprehended the complexity.
Yeah, and there's this, another really nice parallel, which again, I thought very late recently about, was this Kantian definition of enlightenment is to emerge from your own immaturity and from your own kind of childhood and your way of thinking. And I think, again, in their case, it was exactly that autonomy is not about telling someone this is what you should be, but it's about making them go through processes and experiences in a way that enables them to discover these truths by themselves, and where they can just be helped and oriented when they need to, but nobody actually tells you what to do. There isn't this more paternalistic way of interfering with the discovery of the truth.
We have one time very quickly for one last question from Karen Vagland, who's a PhD student at Oslo. I would like to hear a little bit about how this book came about. Have you always wanted to publish your personal biographic novel? And did you encounter any ethical dilemmas regarding sharing your family story?
No, I have not thought about writing my biography ever. And I also don't think of it, actually, I mean, I know it's my biography because I've written about myself and about my family, but I don't think of it as my biography because I think it's only interesting to people if it's a life in a context in which they hear things about concepts that they're already interested in, like freedom, and where they sort of explore these themes with someone in context, but the context is only relevant as an exploration of ideas that they're already interested in and kind of concerned by. So I was not thinking of writing my biography. I wanted to write this philosophical book on ideas of freedom in the liberal and in the socialist traditions. And as I was saying in response to the previous question, I was always interested in the overlaps in these two traditions on the conceptions of freedom. And when I started writing this book that was meant to be for the general public, I kept thinking about examples from my life in Albania, and then it became more and more of a literary project. But I have always been interested in literature. So when I was a teenager, I wrote poems and short stories and published them in Albania. And so I always had this kind of author literary streak in me, which went hand in hand with the academic interest. So I think that's what gave then the book the particular shape that it had, was this very strong interest in literature.
Well, and I think we have really...
The second question, I forgot. So I have part of the reason why every character in the book that is not a member of my family is anonymized to the point of not being recognizable was that I had these dilemmas. And so many of the stories are stories from different characters all put together in one character. So there's heavy dose of fictionalizing in the... in everyone that is not a member of the family. And with my mom and my brother, who are the only ones that were kind of directly being talked about, they read the manuscript, and I gave both of them a pencil and a pen and said, just strike out everything you don't like. And my mom used this right very effectively. She's done it. So, you know, maybe at some point in the future, there will be a kind of director's uncut version of the book where you can see what she's taken out. But she did take a lot of stuff out. So in a way, I had this dilemma and I faced this ethical question, and the way I got around it was by asking for their permission and consent and to let them have a say basically in the book, so.
Fantastic, thank you. Thank you, Karen, that's a really wonderful question that alas we have to close on. And I think, you know, talking about the ethical dilemmas that you had, we have really benefited from you confronting them and going ahead with this book, because I think it's an incredibly moving and also incredibly enlightening book as a way for people to gain very direct sort of immediate insight into what these experiences were like, rather than trying to read it through, you know, abstract political theory and political science and these very sort of, as it were, these you know, these academic texts that can be very sort of bleached of the human reality, the sort of the lived experience again of what these transitions were really like. So let me thank Leah enormously for taking the time to talk with us about this. Thank you to the audience. Thank you so much for joining us and for the people who asked the questions, wonderful questions. I will finish with a quick advertisement. This event is part of a series to celebrate the 30-year anniversary of the European Institute. And so keep an eye on the website because there are a lot of events this year. The next one is actually Wednesday this week on a very different topic. It's a Hamiltonian, the question is a Hamiltonian moment for Europe, demystifying the next generation EU funds and the EU recovery funds. So looking at the European Union and its reaction, not least to the COVID crisis. And that is Wednesday, the 9th of March, 6:30 to 8 p.m. So please join us again for that. And in the meantime, let me just thank everybody for being here and wish you a very good evening. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.